You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on endometrial cancer, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Ursula Matulonis, Chief of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. She's the first recipient of the Brock Wilson Family Chair at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. She co-leads the Gynecologic Cancer Program within the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center and an NCI P01 program project grant that is focused on targeting replication stress in high-grade endometrial cancers. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Ursula Matulonis. Welcome to Season 3 of the Medscape in Discussion Endometrial Cancer podcast series. Today, we'll discuss our guest's career, uterine cancer staging, funding for endometrial cancer, and finally, where the field of endometrial cancer is headed. First, let me introduce my guest, Dr. David Much. Dr. Much is a gynecologic oncologist at Washington University in St. Louis and is the Ira and Judith Gall Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology. He was the former division director of gynecologic oncology for 23 years at WashU, has trained more than 50 fellows, and has published over 500 papers. Dr. Much is currently the principal investigator of Washington University's second endometrial spore, named the Route 66 spore, which I'll ask him about later. It is a true honor to have Dr. Much as my guest on this podcast episode. Dr. Much, welcome to the Medscape in Discussion Endometrial podcast.
Well, thank you very much. I very much appreciate this invitation.
No, it's great to have you here, David. You are truly a legend in the field of gynecologic oncology, and I always love seeing your conferences. You always make me smile. So tell us about what originally drew you to the field of gynecologic oncology.
My dad is an OBGYN in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and I always thought I would just go back and practice with him, and I think he kind of did too. You know, along the way, I was drawn to not do general obstetrics and gynecology. I like the patients in gynecologic oncology. They're a unique set of patients, I think we could all agree. And I can't tell you exactly why they're different than other patients, but I find that they have great insight into their disease. And it's just been really an honor and a pleasure through my whole career to sort of help them through their disease process from beginning to end. And that's a unique feature, I think, of gynecologic oncology. And then after my fellowship at Duke, I was going to go back to Sioux Falls again, but Dr. Kreisman, who was my mentor at that time, said, well, Dave, I don't know, you're pretty good at, you know, academics, so, you know, why don't you give it a try? You know, Sioux Falls' job will always be there. And so I returned to Washington University for family reasons. It was closer, and my wife's parents were there and so on. And I loved Washington University, very much similar to my undergraduate training in that really honored individual thought.
That's great. And, you know, over your career and continuing moving forward, you've been involved in multiple clinical trials in the field of gynecologic oncology and especially endometrial cancer. Which ones are you the most proud of?
Well, so I thought about that question quite a bit, and I have three examples which are different and sort of emphasize, I think, different aspects of the clinical trial process. The first trial that I was involved with was when I was young in the 1990s, and that was the RTOG combination chemo radiation. When those five papers were published, we were given, if you will, by our senior people, Mitch Morris, Perry Grigsby, and myself, the RTOG trial, which we published in the New England Journal, and using, you know, 5-FU cisplatinum as an adjuvant to radiation therapy. Of course, we all know what happened there now. The standard of care is really platinum radiation therapy. 5-FU platinum was a little more toxic and complicated to give. And so I think the standard of care now has become chemotherapy, parentheses platinum, with radiation. But I feel that that's a good example of, you know, senior people, if you will, giving me as a junior person an opportunity to sort of get my name in lights in an important journal. And, you know, that can be really stimulating and rewarding as a young person and kind of keep you on track. And that's something that we should all remember now that we're, at least I do, I try to, now that I'm getting older, papers are less important to me, but they were really important to me then. And so that's a good example of an early one. Then I was sort of involved in the inception of GOG210, which is a tissue protocol. And we just collected endometrial cancers through the GOG, then now NRG, and, you know, almost 6,000 patients. This was driven a little bit by Paul Goodfellow and myself because we were interested in hereditary disease and wanted to use that for our first spore. And fortunately, again, mentors of mine, Dr. Kreisman, Dr. Desai, and of course, with the help of Ted Trimble, you know, 210 was born, along with, I should not forget, Paul Goodfellow and Kathleen Darcy, who are absolutely instrumental in this. So it was, again, you know, team science. It's really hard to do these things in a vacuum without others. And we all build on the shoulders of those that came before us and those who are with us. And anyway, through the course of this now, since its inception in the early 2000s, you know, we published 50 papers out of this, a lot of epi data, but thanks to Ashley Felix and others at the NCI. And then, of course, multiple sort of basic science and histologic papers. So it's been a really successful trial, I think, or protocol. And it continues today. We're still publishing papers. Casey Cosgrove published the Moonshot data paper that will be coming out at the SGO and being published soon about some of the molecular features associated with differences in race. And that comes out of the 210 database system. So it's really a model, I think, of what the power of these sorts of collections of tissue can be. And then the third example would be GOG-258. I was supposed to be, quote, the older mentor, and Daniela Mattei was the younger author at that time and wrote the protocol. And you probably experienced this too, Dr. Matalonis, that sometimes, you know, I learn more from the fellows and my junior people than they learn from me. Don't tell them that often, but they have insights often that I just don't have sometimes now. But I think I helped a lot gathering data, reviewing charts and that sort of thing. And eventually, of course, GOG-258 was published again in the New England Journal. And Daniela shows sort of a funny picture. You may remember this, that she presented the final overall survival data at the SGO, and she showed herself as a pregnant woman when the protocol was written. And now she was presenting the final data, and there was a picture of her and her daughter at college as she dropped her daughter off at college. So that shows you sort of the duration of some of these trials and that it can be frustrating, but I think GOG-258, which randomized patients to chemotherapy versus chemotherapy radiation and showed no difference in this particular patient subset, which is a little bit in conflict with PORTEC-3 in some small subsets of patients, but generally they agree. You know, it shows the need for persistence and, you know, for, again, that we're not in this alone, that, you know, we all build on the shoulders of others.
David, you were involved in the FIGO 2023 endometrial cancer staging changes and kind of new staging updates. Can you tell us about this process and where it's headed now?
So we were charged, a committee through the FIGO, to change the staging system and incorporate molecular features into the staging. And I think it was a little bit controversial because it was, there were lots of changes to a staging system that had been stable for a long period of time. You know, it was published in 2023. And again, as I said, it was controversial. I think it was a good effort, but I think it just came as a huge change and people didn't really see it coming. There is a committee now that will modify this staging and make it a little more palatable. You know, it was really trial unfriendly because we can't be changing the staging system every year as more molecular features come and go. That's happening almost weekly now. So I think we just need to modify it so that the system will be more stable over long periods of time. It will be easier for people to remember and understand, and it will be more clinical trial friendly. And that committee is being led by Alex Olaiway. And I think the process will be slower and gain more consensus of stakeholder organizations. So I think it was a good try and it's here to stay, but I think we need to, you know, modify it so that it's more user-friendly.
Yeah. Well, certainly congratulations on on really placing these molecular changes, which you said are changing quite often, into staging system and really making it contemporary in how we treat our patients with endometrial cancer. So thank you so much. David, you are a pioneer in the field of gyn-onc. I'd just love to hear your thoughts on how you've seen the field change and what do you see ahead?
Well, in all cancers now, there's just a huge information explosion and rapidity of data and then rapidly changing targets and so on because of the molecular features of these diseases that we're understanding. I mean, liquid tumors and lymphomas and so on are a prime example of that. And endometrial cancer now and gynecologic cancers, other solid tumors are not far behind. And so, you know, sort of just have to hold on to your hats as these new features emerge and we do clinical trials on them to determine which are useful and which are not, and those that are not. So, you know, just to give you an example, from 1900 to the 1980s, endometrial cancer treatment was pretty stable, right? Everybody got surgery plus or minus some sort of radiation therapy. We didn't really know about even histology and poor prognostic features or depth of invasion, LBSI, things that we take for granted nowadays. And then four individuals, Bill Kreisman, Phil Desaia, Paul Morrow, and Dick Morneau, were charged in the late 1970s when the GOG was young. The NCI said, well, you guys don't really have any trials. You need to do something. And so a pilot study to stage patients was undertaken. And then that led to GOG 33, which was simply a accumulation of patients that underwent a TAH BSO nodes. And we were sort of off to the races at that time. I was a fellow at Duke when that was undertaken or ongoing. And it really did change if you think of all the things that we now just take for granted with endometrial cancer, depth of invasion, lymphovascular space involvement, degree of differentiation, on and on. That was born out of GOG 33. And then there was a period of time where we tried to determine, you know, well, who needs radiation therapy, who needs doesn't. And there wasn't a huge change, but I think we were able to diminish the number of patients that got radiation. But we didn't really have any good chemotherapy yet, of course. And then we did finally start chemotherapies, adriamycin and platinum, and then finally taxanes were shown to be of some benefit. And then the controversy, of course, has come, and GOG 258 was born out of that. What is better, you know, chemotherapy or radiation? But we moved slowly ahead for the next 20, almost 30 years. And then with the advent of, you know, the TCGA and our understanding of the molecular features of endometrial cancer, the hereditary part, largely some from our first spore, and then, of course, from the TCGA study that was published. Doug Levine was the first author on that paper and showed the four histologic types or molecular types. And then that was published in the 2010s, a little after 2013 or whatever. And then since that time, there's just been an explosion in our understanding of this disease, such that in 2024, we came to understand why, you know, that IOs, immune modulators, pembrolizumab and dostarlimab could be helpful in the treatment of these patients, thanks largely to Hans Niedermann's understanding that these patients are, and demonstration that these patients generate lots and lots of neoantigens, which sort of prime the immune system. And now, you know, there's just an explosion, as you know, of other features, you know, like expression on the surface, HER2, folate receptors, which will come to be and are being studied. I think there are 200 ADCs that are being studied right now for just endometrial cancer alone. So, I mean, there's just a huge explosion that's going to accelerate. And, you know, those are being driven, again, somewhat by the NRG. You know, Matt Powell, one of our fellows and faculty members at WashU, is the head of the Corpus Committee. And then, of course, at Harvard, Brigham, you have Jessica St. Lawrence. And she's like on the cutting edge of this. The field is, just with respect to endometrial cancer, but all cancers is really just exploding in a positive way.
I completely agree. That is an incredible summary of the field. And I think certainly, as you've alluded to, the field is catching up with other cancers. We're learning from other cancers. And every individual, every patient who's got endometrial cancer is unique features and really needs to be, you know, really discussed in a multidisciplinary way. So thank you for that. I'd like to move on to a grant that you're majorly part of, and that's the Route 66 SPORE. And then talk about endometrial cancer funding overall. So for the audience, the term SPORE, S-P-O-R-E, stands for Specialized Program of Research Excellence. This is a federally funded grant, very hard to get, involves typically a very large team, and can be focused on one disease. So in the case of the Route 66 SPORE, led by David Much and colleagues, this grant is focused on endometrial cancer. So David, please tell us about this grant.
So a SPORE grant, as you're pointing out, is a sort of a team effort, team science, art is I, science is we. And in this particular SPORE involves three centers, four actually, if you count UCSF. And it's called the Route 66 SPORE because it follows the Route 66, St. Louis, Oklahoma, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we have three principal investigators, myself at Washington University, Doris Benbrook at Oklahoma, and Kim Leslie at University of New Mexico. And it's a collaborative effort of all three. We've been together for 20 years plus and got to know each other through the GOG NRG, hence our interest in endometrial cancer along with Paul Goodfellow. And so it has three projects. One is an SEDA2 compound that we are studying. I use the royal we because that's really Doris's project, and she has shepherded this compound through her whole career and deserves credit for sort of bringing it to the forefront. But it's a relatively non-toxic drug that actually kicks out P53 from, you know, some chaperone proteins like, you know, heat shock proteins and mortalin that, you know, might sequester abnormal P53. And that's good because that potentiates, or we believe potentiates, the activity of other chemotherapeutic agents. Then there's a new marker, AXL, which we have a competing zanzanetinib, which is from a company called Exelixis, and that AXL is associated with poor survival. It's associated with P53 expression and poor prognostic endometrial cancers, and we are testing the utility of this drug along with the standard chemotherapy drugs and trying to understand how it works. Then we have project three is patients with pre-invasive disease and an attempt to, especially in younger women who want to maybe continue childbearing, to determine if weight loss and the GLP agonist along with hormonal therapy might help reverse endometrial hyperplasia, precancerous abnormalities, or even early endometrial cancer by controlling weight and then, you know, seeing if there's synergy then also with the direct effect of these GLP agonists on the endometrium. And then we have two supplemental grants. One really cool, I think, is that we applied for as they posted an RFA. We match the human immune system with the tumor, and the immune system of a immune compromised mouse is replaced by the human immune system. And then we use PDX models within those mice to try to determine then the immunologic features that might, you know, affect chemotherapy use, particularly the IOs, as we talked about before. And then we have some others. What I'm most proud about, though, of the SPORE is we have 20 CEPs and DRPs, that is sort of pilot grants that we funded. And many of them are really good. We're sort of considering resubmission, and we sent out a local RFA, if you will, and we have 21 queries. So that's going to, will we break into, you know, how will we break that down into team science and advise everybody how they can best move their projects forward and further. And that actually is really exciting at this stage of my career, that research in endometrial cancer will continue.
Yeah. Spores are great at all levels of academic medicine in terms of that you get the young faculty applying for the CEP grants and then more senior faculty working on some of the projects along side by side by junior faculty. So congratulations on that grant.
Well, and I know you've had spores and,
yep.
and are they,
yep.
We had one spore and then we had a drought of, I don't know, 8 or 9 years. And then we were able to re-up and I don't know what will happen in the future.
Takes a lot of work, but they're really gratifying and important to have. And kind of on that line of thought, you know, we know federal funding for endometrial cancer is one of the lowest of all cancers, whereas we also know that endometrial cancer incidence and mortality continue to rise, especially mortality in the 2026 cancer statistics. So can you give any advice and thoughts about how researchers can access more funding for endometrial cancer?
Well, I mean, there are several mechanisms, you know, like the DOD is now allowing endometrial cancer And I think that NCI is on to the fact that endometrial cancer is woefully underfunded. Thankfully, now we have two spores in endometrial cancer. Vicky Bejump just got a disparity spore at the University of North Carolina. And then, of course, we have the Route 66 spore. And, you know, in the past, Karen Liu has had an endometrial spore. So I think all of these CEPs and DRPs, that is career enhancement programs and development research programs through the spores, will and could lead to added interest in endometrial cancer. I just think we have to keep plugging away. But I do see that we are, you know, slowly lifting ourselves up by the bootstraps with regard to this disease.
And I think it's so important that researchers have to apply for grants, get the foundational experiments going, and then apply. Because if we don't apply, for sure, we're not going to get the grant. Yeah, that's really important. So, David, any final thoughts today that you'd like to share with the audience about anything, yourself, your career, research, your impact on the field?
Yeah, I think that we all live, if you will, or have risen on the shoulders of giants. I've had great mentors, few of whom I mentioned. I have great colleagues, which includes you, Dr. Matalonis, and many others. And then, you know, we have students, and which include fellows, house officers, and medical students. And I think we need to continue to work as a group and recognize that we all learn from each other. And no matter if you go into academic medicine or not, we still sort of all as professionals, I think, live by something I like to think of, and you too, I'm sure, Ursula, is the tripartite mission. We're doctors or physicians, or we take care of patients. We have to do that because that's what we were trained to do. But in order for others who come after us to take care of patients, we have to do teaching. And then we have to do research so that those people who come after us can do a better job than we did. And I think that, you know, no matter what level that you're involved in of our profession in terms of the academic part, I think that everyone should take that notion with them. If you're in Murdo, South Dakota, you're going to take care of patients. You're going to train nurses. You're probably going to learn and read and maybe do some local research on issues that arise. So I don't think it's isolated to us, if you will, and what one might call an ivory tower. It's really the responsibility of all of us as physicians to carry forth that sort of creed, in my opinion.
Yeah. David, thank you. It's been such a pleasure and honor to have you as a guest on today's podcast. Today, we've talked to Dr. Mutch about his thoughts and perspective on the field of endometrial cancer and where the field is headed. We talked about Dr. Mutch's illustrious career and specific trials that he is especially proud of. We talked about ways to increase research funding for endometrial cancer. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please take a moment to download the Medscape app to listen and subscribe to this podcast series on endometrial cancer. This is Dr. Ursula Matalonis for the Medscape In Discussion Endometrial Cancer Podcast.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Endometrial Cancer Podcast series with our host, Dr. Ursula Matalonis. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on endometrial cancer.